Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Putting two virtuoso performers together in concert and in a very special place is a sound prescription for first-rate entertainment. Soprano Christine Brewer and organist Paul Jacobs will join us in a few minutes to talk about their performance this week. But first, a respected medical doctor who happens to be black has learned you can't always write a prescription for racial tolerance. His story is well told in the book, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. He is Dr. Damon Tweedy. Dr. Tweedy is assistant professor of psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center and staff physician at the Durham VA Medical Center. He's a graduate of Duke Medical School and also Yale Law School. He'll be in town later this week to talk about his book, and he joins us now from Raleigh. Doctor, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to begin this way, if I may, before getting into some of the conclusions that you've reached over your career. Give us some sense, if you would, of the difficulties you faced early on being a black doctor, and if the difficulties of that sort have really changed very much over the last 20 years or so.
Yeah, so this book really has two themes. So the one theme is about my experience as a black doctor and the ways in which that experience is different in some ways than other physicians, both in medical school and as a young doctor. And there's also this other theme about the health of African-American patients. So it's really these two stories weaved into one. So the book actually begins, the first chapter begins as a first-year medical student. And, you know, I'm coming to Duke from a working-class background in Maryland, all African-American community, and coming to Duke and kind of feeling insecure just about, you know, how I'm going to, you know, make it here. You come on an affirmative action scholarship, and you have all these different thoughts that go through your mind. And so about a month, 3 or 4 weeks into that first semester, I'm coming to the classroom from a break, and a professor comes up to me during the break and kind of approaches me as I enter the classroom. And in a sort of angry, irritated way, you know, he asked me if I'm there to fix the lights in the classroom. And so that was one of my sort of first, kind of struck me as a, you know, kind of almost like an uppercut in the world, because in a way, because you're sort of already insecure about your experiences there, and if you're going to make it, and then you have your professor sort of in a way kind of questioning you as well, and it sort of went further than that. It wasn't just that sort of initial mistaken identity. It was he sort of followed up by saying, well, then if you're not here for this, then why are you, you know, here in my class today? So it was really kind of a stark moment in that first event.
But you didn't challenge him.
You know, all sorts of thoughts go through your head in that moment. You know, there's a part of you that's angry, there's a part of you that's hurt. You know, I mean, as a young African-American man, you certainly have experienced, I've certainly experienced people sort of misperceiving me as different things all throughout my, you know, young life. You know, one day you're a basketball star, next day you're a potential criminal. You know, all these sorts of things that you experience. But it's one thing to have that happen to someone who doesn't know you, and it's like a stranger who you might see once and never again. And it's a different experience when it's the professor in your course who's sort of kind of in control in a way of your the next step for you. And so it's a totally different dynamic. So I thought about, you know, maybe challenging him, and thought, well, you know, how's it going to work out? He's the one that's in charge of my grades. If I go over him, are people going to understand, you know, what I was feeling? Like, would they think that I'm just sort of hypersensitive and trying to make everything racial? And so there are all these things that go through your mind. And so for me, the way that I dealt with it was to really kind of put my head down and excel, you know, to the highest degree. And that was the way that I was able to manage that situation.
But that was not the last contact you had with this professor. You were an academic standout, and I guess that caught him by surprise as well.
Yeah, so at the very end of that chapter, I talk about, you know, that encounter where I come back to him at the very end of the semester. I end up scoring the second highest grade on the final exam, but my midterm score wasn't so great, so I wasn't sure where I ended up at the very end of the course, and did I get honors, which is like the top 5 or 10% of students. And so I came to him at that very end of the course, and he was quite surprised. I mean, he was so surprised, in fact, that he actually invited me to work in his lab. He was so excited about. It was almost like it wasn't just a genuine excitement. It was almost like a disbelief, you know, that an African American student could excel in the way that I had in that class. So it was kind of bittersweet in a way. You know, the part of you is proud of what you've done, what I'd done, but the part of me was also, you know, kind of left with this sort of bitter feeling.
Well, once you got that white coat, and since, has that attitude changed, or do you keep running into it?
Well, I think here's two things. So, you know, that was 1996, so it's nearly 20 years ago. At that point in time, Duke was in a period of transition in terms of what you might call the old way, in terms of having very few minority students, to really increasing the numbers in the medical school. So since that time, you know, Duke has a woman named Brenda Armstrong, who's the dean of admissions, and she's a former African-American student at Duke herself, many years earlier than me. And so she's really helped recruit a sizable number of African-American students to Duke in the medical school. So I think that the sort of the numbers game has helped in the sense of the perception on that end. For me personally, you know, as you get older, you start to look older and people assume that you have a certain level of experience. And I think for some people that helps people think that, well, if he's gotten this far, he must know what he's doing kind of thing. But I still think younger students still struggle with some of these things, particularly when they get out into the medical ward in the hospital. They still struggle with some of these misperceptions. But I hope to think it's a little bit better than it was 20 years ago. But there's still some lingering issues for sure.
Well, again, it is 20 years ago. You recount several instances of your book in which you have meetings and sessions with patients who are white and sessions with patients who are black. Give us, again, some sense of how that went, then we'll move on to other things.
Yeah, no, so again, that's the other piece of it. So this occurred, so as you finish that first year of medical school, you're doing coursework, and then as you get into the second and third year, you start to see patients and get out in the real world in a way, and you get a real experience of things, and a lot of that, big part of that is seeing patients and seeing them out in the real world. And so, yes, there are people who had very different perceptions of me. And so, and the book talks about that. So sometimes it could be a positive impression. Like there's an example where I'm going to this rural clinic and their patients are all black and they're really excited to see a black doctor. They hadn't seen, particularly a black man, hadn't seen that in, you know, ages, I guess is how they put it. And then there was a case in the book I talk about where there's a, you know, white patient, an older white patient who was, you know, less than thrilled to see me. Now certainly there were many white patients who were perfectly fine, but in this particular case, this is an old gentleman. He was in his early 70s and had his name is Chester. I refer to him as Chester in the book, and he came in with pneumonia. Ended up having terminal cancer actually, but we didn't know that in the beginning. And when he comes into the hospital, his first words are after meeting some of the nursing staff and seeing that there are a lot of black providers at the hospital, he says that he doesn't want a black doctor. Only he uses the N-word to describe that. To sort of make his preferences known. And so when I came down there, now I'm actually the only black doctor on the medical team in this hospital. There's several teams of doctors, and I was the only team that had where there was a black doctor. And so it was only his, I guess, fortune that he was assigned to my team. And when I first heard that, I was very surprised. Obviously, I was kind of shocked. It was sort of like another one of those uppercuts that you feel, because at this point in my training, I was a first year medical resident. So this is like the first year that you're an MD. And so, yeah, the story in this chapter really kind of goes through how I dealt with that experience, not only with him, but with his family. The family, they were dressed in Confederate flag attire, and they sort of had that really kind of what I thought was a kind of that racist, experience. They were tattooed with Confederate flags. And so it was kind of scary for me from my vantage point anyway. And so I talk about how I had to navigate that really complicated situation.
I won't tell the audience how that turned out. We'll let them read the book to find out.
Exactly.
But, you know, this is a two-way street, too. Again, you recount a situation in which some white doctors, some of your peers, took prejudicial action against some of their black patients.
Yeah, so I really explore all the dynamics, and it's a very complicated mix of things. So this is also that same year, so this is the chapter after the story about Chester, and this is a story about a patient referred to as Gary. And this is a gentleman in his early 50s, had chest pain, came to the hospital making sure he didn't have a heart attack. You know, that's always the first thing you're concerned about when you have chest pain. So the initial tests were negative. He didn't have a heart attack. So then you start to look at, oh, what is the next step? We're going to give you, you know, certain medications to lower your blood pressure and, you know, help you quit smoking, those sorts of things. And so in this particular case, you know, this gentleman, the team wanted to give him a certain type of blood pressure medicine, and he wanted to try to improve his diet and lose weight first. And you know, that's pretty reasonable, very reasonable approach to things, you know, to try and, you know, because diet and exercise can do a lot to lower your blood pressure. And so he seemed more knowledgeable, I think, than they expected. And he used some terms that really, I think, caught them by surprise. I mean, but it wasn't like they were sort of like, you didn't have to be a PhD or an MD to know these terms, but it was an example. This guy had read a little bit about things, and they were very surprised by that because we were in a public hospital setting. And so instead of focusing on the medical aspects of his case, after we left the room, they started talking about, well, does this guy have is he obsessive compulsive, or what kind of psychiatric issues is going on? So this is a gentleman who really came in the hospital with chest pain and medical issues and kind of left the hospital with this label of having, psychiatric illness, obsessive compulsive, personality, which was really surprising because, I mean, there's nothing about, and I'm a psychiatrist now, and there was nothing about his presentation that would make you think that, at least not me, think that on the surface.
And that's
so it's an example of how, perceptions and what expectations we have of people based on race or their socioeconomic class, and how that can sort of influence diagnoses.
And one of the points there is the fact that this conclusion that the other doctors reached or put in his medical records are there in the records forever and could affect him in other ways down the road.
Yeah, psychiatric diagnosis is not benign at all. I mean, because doctors, we chart often before we see patients. Someone has a psychiatric diagnosis that definitely influences how you that could potentially influence how you approach that patient, for better or for worse, often for worse. I mean, there's a whole line of statistics, the whole line of research showing how psychiatric patients themselves are not treated well in the medical setting. So that's a whole other layer. And this is something that he may have faced now that was totally unnecessary and unfortunate.
Well, the other theme of your book is that being black can be bad for your health. That's a direct quote from you. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, you look at the statistics, basically any disease just about that you can think of, it's going to be more common in black people. And the disease outcomes tends to be worse in African Americans. And so this is the lesson that you would learn. I learned as a first year medical student over and over again. Heart disease, diabetes, stroke, cancer, no matter what you no matter what the disease, it seemed like that was the refrain you'd hear. And it's true, I mean, to a large extent. So life expectancy is shorter in African Americans. Infant mortality is significantly greater. The risk of high blood pressure, diabetes, all these sorts of things that we hear about are much higher in African Americans. And so as a medical student, you know, you hear that information, but you don't get the next step, which is like, why is that? And what can we do about it? And so that's a lot of what the book's about, is really trying to explore those answers by using the stories of patients that I saw along the way to really explore these larger problems.
Yeah, we'll talk in some more detail when we come back about some of the reasons for all of this. But I would just like to point out, and I mentioned to you before we went on the air, that a significant study was completed here just a few months ago in St. Louis called For the Sake of All. I know you'll be meeting with some of these folks tomorrow, but basically the same conclusions. And as I mentioned to you, and I've mentioned often on this program, one of the things they found out was that you take an affluent zip code and one that is not so affluent, and they found in cases here that there was a disparity in longevity of 18 years.
Wow. Yeah, that's incredible.
It is incredible, and you'll learn more about that tomorrow. And as I say, we've discussed that much on this air, but it really is quite striking how the health issue affects people and affects their life and lives. We'll be back with Dr. Tweedy in just a moment. Dr. Damon Tweedy is author of Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. He'll be appearing Thursday evening at 7 o'clock at the St. Louis County Library headquarters on Lindbergh. Back with Dr. Tweedy in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Dr. Damon Tweedy. Doctor, let's talk now about some of the reasons for these disparities in health care for African Americans. You have a list of them. I'll start with the first one. One is very basic. It's lack of access.
Yeah, so I illustrate this in a chapter in a book, early chapter. This is where I'm still in medical school. And one day on a Saturday morning, we went out to a clinic about 90 minutes from campus. This is the eastern part of North Carolina, which has a very large African-American population. It's a very poor part of the state. And so you go out there, and it's a clinic that's really well, it's called a clinic, but it's actually taking place in like a one-room house. It's an old sort of country shack. And you're there once a month. So it's a team of student volunteers and doctors go out there once a month. And it's pretty clear from the beginning that you're providing a different level of care. So the patients there, they only have a chance to see you on a Saturday, you know, like I said, once a month. They don't have health insurance. And the type of care you can provide is really different. I mean, so you know, people have very preventable medical problems. And I give examples in the book of women that I saw, very preventable, basic medical problems. But then here we don't have access to provide medications for them, to do lab testing, to monitor their issues, and to refer them to specialists when problems come up. And it was a really stark illustration of just how basic, something as basic as access to care, how huge a difference it really makes. We have this discussion about healthcare reform, but we really need to take a step back and just think about how important that really first step is in having health insurance.
Yeah, as we go through some of these things, I think it will be easier for people to understand why there is this disparity in longevity. Health insurance, of course, is a major issue.
Absolutely. So that's one huge issue. So the other issue, another big issue that you uncover in a setting like that and in other settings is this whole idea of the doctor-patient relationship and how important that is to healthcare. And so in this particular case, as I was mentioning, so you're a different team of doctors go and students goes out every month. So there you sort of start, the patient is left to sort of start over. You don't have the continuity to build a relationship with someone who knows you. And that's a huge issue in medicine. All too often, African-American people in particular receive medical care at things like urgent care clinics and emergency rooms where the doctor doesn't know you and, you know, is in a rush state where they're trying to, you know, move you in and out. And those are the settings where people sort of stereotype and bias of African-Americans in particular in this case can come out and be most harmful in settings like that. And so I think that's another really important piece of that. So there's actually an example in the book where I talk about that, where I was a patient and I went to an urgent care clinic and I was in a sort of dressed very casually and in a rushed state. And the doctor, you know, initially didn't acknowledge me, if you will. I mean, didn't examine me, didn't look at me in the eye. And then once I made it known that I was a doctor, everything kind of completely switched. And it was a completely different type of care that I received. And to me, it was an illustration of how differently medical care can be delivered in a setting, you know, based on the provider's perception of the patient. So that's another big piece of it. Another aspect of that doctor-patient relationship, though, however, is from the standpoint of the patient. African-Americans often have a wariness or mistrust of the healthcare system. So even when doctors are well-meaning and have great intentions, the African-American patients may be less likely to follow advice when you think about the sort of history the African-Americans have had in terms of medical care and being treated in separate wards and having been involved in experiments without their awareness. And these are things that happened 40, 50 years ago. Seems like a long time ago, but there's certainly a very strong cultural memory of those things. So that really plays out as well in the medical setting and can contribute to health outcomes that are different.
And then, of course, there's a Medicaid issue, and a lot of states are cutting back because they don't have the money to deal with that.
Well, that's a whole other piece of the sort of expanding health insurance is that, well, the Supreme Court kind of left it up to states whether not to expand Medicaid. And so what's often happened is a sort of a paradox that the states that are often the poorest and have the largest African-American populations are the states least likely to have expanded, health insurance coverage through Medicaid. So that's another one of the paradoxes.
Missouri is one of them.
And so is North Carolina.
Well, I think there are about 30 states, something like that. I forgot
the
number.
It's like 25 states, like half the states pretty much.
Aside from that, and that, of course, is certainly a big component, is Obamacare going to change some of the things we've been talking about?
Well, I mean, I think health insurance is a necessary step. It's like a first step. It's necessary but not sufficient. I mean, so it's certainly part of the process, and certainly a start. I don't think that it's going to and I think many people have gotten health insurance as a result of that, but it's certainly not going to fix all the problems. I mean, again, we talked about the doctor-patient relationship. I mean, that's a huge aspect of it. And so there's one aspect of Obamacare is trying to get more people, or the Affordable Care Act, is trying to get more people into primary care. But one issue is that there's actually a shortage of primary care doctors from the standpoint of physicians and who's going to provide care to the patients. I mean, so there are a lot of variables that I think the Affordable Care Act is going to address, but not completely address, for sure. And then there's a lot of other issues in terms of communities, in terms of poverty, in terms of education. And these are bigger issues that can definitely impact health. And so Affordable Care Act is really about health insurance largely.
Yeah, but people, if they're not subject to Medicaid benefits, they're still going to have to buy it. And for poor people, that means an expense they might not be able to meet.
Yeah, so I know there's some provisions for subsidies and things of that sort to help lower-income people, but there's no doubt there are people that will fall through the cracks. At the end of the book, I talk about some examples of that where I go back to some of these rural clinics that I went to as a medical student, and you can sort of see there's some people have been helped, but there's still people falling through the cracks. So it's like it's a start, but it's certainly not the destination we need to get at.
Is it worse? Is the situation worse in the rural areas than it is in the urban areas?
I think they're probably they each have their own problems. I would say, in terms of primary care, I don't know if it's worse in either place. I mean, certainly in terms of access to specialists, it's going to be more likely to be worse in rural areas, because there's a shortage of providers in those areas, and then you sort of have a more geographic isolation. But I think the needs are great in both. I mean, so that's where you find people really struggling the most in both settings. And I give examples of that in the book of the time I was in a rural clinic, and also the time that I was in an inner city Atlanta and working at Grady Hospital, which is a sort of well known public hospital. So you see many of the same problems in both locations.
Another area that you get into in the book with regard to issues facing basically the African-American population is the unhealthy lifestyles, nutrition being a big part of that.
Yeah, it's a huge part. I mean, there's no way to, I mean, so that's another component to the puzzle. There's a lot of layers to that. So some of that is a function of poverty, and some of that's a function of having access to the kind of foods that that would need to eat better. But there's also this cultural side to it. And I use myself as an example. You know, I came from a working class family, kind of grew up in a sort of Southern way of eating, and developed high blood pressure myself as a young person. And it was just very surprising because I was, you know, thin and seemed to be healthy on the outside. And so I talk about in the book the struggles that it took for me to change my diet and how it was more complicated than just sort of making change. Change is hard for everyone, but it was more complicated because there's this idea of changing food, meaning shedding cultural identity, and it's all very complicated. And so I think as a doctor, being able to understand the barriers that your patient faces and sort of it really can be helpful in terms of meeting their needs. So I think that's another important piece to the puzzle as well.
Well, in many ways, things that you described 20 years ago have not obviously changed very much since then. Where do we go from here? How do we get where we have to be to ensure, you know, a healthy population of all races?
You know, it's really interesting. So a big part of my book has really been education. I mean, because certain people know about this information and they sort of take it for granted, but there's such a large section of the population as the very educated population that has no idea about these health differences. I mean, I've gotten so much feedback like, wow, I never knew this. People are familiar talking about race when they're talking about issues like the criminal justice system and, you know, and crime and punishment. People are aware of the racial disparities there. But so many people aren't even aware of this. I mean, I take it for granted because I've been in this field for so long. But, I mean, it's just been a huge issue of awareness. And I think that's the first step, just people understanding it. But then there's the other piece about sort of inspiring people to do better and to realize the roles that they have. And so I've taken upon myself to sort of talk to doctors, talk to medical students, to try and teach them about how do you interact with this African-American patient who might be different than you. You know, how are you able to understand their history and their context, but still seeing them as an individual person? And that's really the balance that doctors need to be able, you know, to strike. And so there's several missions in the book. And as far as the bigger problem, I mean, it's really an all hands on deck situation. You know, we got to have issues at the system level. We need issues with educating doctors. We also have to educate and empower patients. I mean, all these things need to happen simultaneously. And, you know, there's signs of progress. I mean, it's not like, I mean, we've painted a bleak picture, but there are signs of progress. But again, we still have a long way to go.
Well, for there to be progress, you'd have to have white doctors taking care of black patients and vice versa.
Absolutely.
And one of the things you point out in the book is that you were very conscious at one point of what you called pairings. That is, that they would try to match you up with black patients.
Yeah, so the issue there is the numbers just don't kind of add up. So, you know, African-Americans are 13% of the population nationwide, 4% of the physician population. So you can see the numbers don't really add up right there. It's even more accentuated in places like, for instance, St. Louis, where the African-American population is about 50%. Mm-hmm. In Durham here in North Carolina, it's about 40%. And that's actually kind of all across the country. At many of these top medical centers, you see very large African-American populations, but small numbers of physicians. And so what I found was that I would often be one of the few African-American doctors, I mean, particularly in psychiatry in my field, and I'd be this expectation I would see all these African-American patients. It's a tough road. And so I think certainly we need more African-American doctors. That's one answer to the problem. But I think we also need to be able to educate other providers about, you know, how can we provide the best care that we can to people who do not look like us and have our same experiences.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's it. That's it.
Our time is beginning to wind down. There were a couple of other things that I'd like to just bring into the equation. You also are a graduate of Yale Law School. Wasn't the years you spent studying medicine enough for you?
Yeah, and, you know, my wife and my mom were like, "Is this guy ever going to stop? Are you ever going to stop going to school and get a real job?" So, you know, I got that a few times. But, you know, I really got interested in. I started medical school, and I was actually thinking that it was all objective, and everything would just be sort of, I'm going to be a surgeon and that sort of thing. And then once I got into medicine, I realized how subjective things were and how much socioeconomic things influence health. And that's where I got this idea of wanting to be involved in government and policy. And that's sort of how law school kind of fit in with me. So it wasn't the sort of traditional courtroom kind of stuff, but this idea of being involved with health policy and shaping society in that way.
Getting into medicine, did you feel getting into it that you would have a commitment to the African-American population we're talking about that is in so need of a better medical care?
I thought about it, yeah. I mean, certainly it's something in your back of your mind. I mean, my grandmother had died early in medical school from heart disease and stroke and some of these conditions that are more common in Black people. So it was certainly there in my mind, but I thought that I'd be more of sort of a hands-on kind of, you know, surgery type person. And but I think it was really more of this idea that I could be, you know, be an example to other people. So that was sort of the role that I did. And many African-American students who go to medical school do profess sort of an increased desire to help the African community. So there's certainly another reason to have more African-American doctors, for sure.
One final thought, and that is that you mentioned several times in your book that you had exposure to and met on several occasions with Dr. Ben Carson, the neurosurgeon who is now running for president. What do you think about this candidacy?
Yeah, so it's really interesting because Dr. Carson was very much a sort of a an African American icon or hero. I mean, there's no doubt about that, and he inspired a whole generation of African American physicians. You know, as far as the, you know, I think it's a good idea to have more doctors, you know, in the political arena. But you know, his style is more. It's not so much his views, but it's his style, which I find kind of a departure from his former sort of way he carried himself. He's much more sort of confrontational and those sorts of things. And was even in the past, he seemed much more of a sort of humble kind of voice of reason. So it seems like his style has changed, and maybe that's just the nature of politics. That's the beast of politics. But he's certainly in the thick of a lot of controversy. There's no doubt about that.
He certainly is, and he's still running a solid number two. So
absolutely,
we shall see. Damon Tweedy, Dr. Damon Tweedy, thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on the book. It's a great read and it's something a lot of people should be thinking about and reading. Thank you.
Yes, I look forward to being there. Thank you.
Yeah, we look forward to seeing you. Dr. Tweedy will be here appearing on Thursday evening at 7 o'clock at the St. Louis County Library headquarters on Lindbergh. He'll discuss his book, Black Man in a White Coat. Coming up, soprano Christine Brewer and organist Paul Jacobs. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.